Today I've been talking some about some of the qualities of our minds and hearts that serve to veil or distort our capacity to be awake, to have a sense of inner freedom. And this afternoon I'd like to focus more on this other side, that the Buddha talks so much about what we cultivate, the qualities of our heart and mind that really, in a way, enable wakefulness, enable freedom. And when I speak about these qualities, I think it's very important to remember that the seeds of these qualities lie within each of our hearts and minds. They're not reserved for a select few. So we start with mindfulness. Start with mindfulness. Now, I think that you're probably all aware the degree to which the word mindfulness has very much entered our culture. It's become naturalized into our vocabulary. It's something that's cultivated in intensive retreats and is somewhat being presented as a cure for everything from antisocial behavior to graffiti to depression. Right? So clearly it's become a big word. If you go into any bookstore, you'll find a book on mindful parenting, mindful relationship, mindful sex, mindful surfing. And then recently I was sitting in my dentist's office and picked up a magazine, as you do, and there on the cover was Mindfulness in Three Easy Steps. And I thought, well, this sounds good, you know. And it went on to stop, breathe, be aware of your body. Mindfulness in Three Easy Steps. I'm sure that would be very helpful. But it's important to be aware that mindfulness is really used in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's used as a kind of something that I do. You know, I've heard people say, I do mindfulness. At times it's almost presented as a sort of inner tyrant, as an inner judge, a kind of scolding voice that either within ourselves or that we imagine from others. You know, I dropped my salad. I wasn't very mindful. You know, and you can hear that voice sort of start up inwardly as if this particular really rather small event in the scale of universal events has become something of a kind of a signal of personal failure. You know, I wasn't mindful enough. Sometimes mindfulness is kind of used synonymously with a sort of observation or watching, a kind of a removed position of a sort of neutral observer, a witness, so to speak. What is clear, certainly it's clear in my experience and in many, many arenas, is that mindfulness can really have a very profound effect on people's hearts, on people's minds, on people's lives. Whether it's in intensive retreat situations or whether it is in daily life applications. That mindfulness seems to be a very crucial piece in, or part of the landscape of very deep transformation. Part of the landscape of transforming some of our most embedded psychological and emotional habits that cause distress and struggle. It does indeed seem that mindfulness and habit do not coexist. And that is something with very profound implications for us in our lives. Not just in the sort of ordinary habits we might think about how we make tea, but in the much deeper psychological and emotional habits. Mindfulness, it seems, plays a part as a key to transforming the way that we see ourselves, because this too can be a habit, a belief system. a key in transforming how we see and how we relate and how we think. And in this sense, mindfulness is certainly not something we do, but it is a way of understanding. Mindfulness is pointing towards it's sometimes called a rotation in consciousness. It's a reorientation in our minds of how we relate to all things. And yet, even as we can acknowledge the power that mindfulness seems to have, I think there's often also a sense of mystery about it. How does it work? Why does mindfulness have such an effect? And what I'd like to endeavor to do this afternoon is to explore the way that mindfulness is used in Buddhist psychology and to understand the very rich fabric of mindfulness, which may, I hope, go some way to explaining or understanding how mindfulness is actually so effective and transformative, and also to understanding how challenging the landscape of mindfulness can be. First of all, I think it's very important to mention that this word sati, which is the Pali word for mindfulness, is one of the most frequently used words in the early texts. But it's also important to mention that sati, or mindfulness, is not the same as another frequently used word, which is manaskara, or attention. And I think these two often do get confused. I mean, attention is a quality and a factor of all of our minds. It can be skillful or unskillful. It can be wholesome, it can be all unwholesome. We all need attention. We all need attention to know how to function. We need attention to learn anything. We need attention just to prevent ourselves from being run over by a bus. And again, it can be skillful and wholesome. There's a wholesome attention used in learning to play an instrument, to raise a child, to listen to another person. There's a wholesome attention being developed. But attention can also be unskillful and unwholesome. Burglars, snipers, shoplifters all have very finely honed skills of attention, necessary if they're going to have a good outcome in their task. So this distinction is very, very important, because when I use the word wholesome or unwholesome, please be aware that this is a very poor translation of a Pali word, which is kusala. And kusala translated means ennobling, that which ennobles our life, which brings nobility to our life. The qualities of heart and mind that bring nobility to our thoughts, our words, our actions. And I think sometimes when we hear the words wholesome or unwholesome, which I say is a very poor translation, it all gets mixed up in that soup of good and bad and right and wrong, which has nothing to do with what is kusala or ennobling. So what is being really suggested is that attention arises from a whole spectrum of other things, doesn't it? Attention rises from intention, from habits, from preferences, from tendencies, what makes us really pay attention to one thing and not pay attention to something else. And that arising of attention that is colored and always shaped, shapes our attitude and shapes our outcomes. So when I use the word skillful or unskillful, or wholesome or unwholesome, I'm only referring to the kind of intention and attention that is unskillful if it leads to distress, sorrow, struggle, alienation, and skillful if it leads to the end of distress, the end of struggle, and the end of alienation. Now, this word sati, again, that is usually translated as mindfulness, and I think that's where the translation falls short. Because sati is really referring to a landscape of our hearts, a landscape of our minds. And in Buddhist psychology, and I'm going to use the word mindfulness anyway, even though it's always overused, mindfulness never stands alone. Mindfulness is always in an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing conversation with a range of other qualities, with wise intention, with wise effort, with calmness, with equanimity, with investigation. Mm-hmm. All of this is part of the landscape of sati or mindfulness. All of these qualities are part of the landscape that awakens our heart, that liberates our heart, and is the fabric of insight. The way that sati is used in Buddhist psychology as such is always an ennobling quality. It is always a skillful quality, simply because it has a singular intention. And the intention of mindfulness is certainly not just to eyeball something more closely. But the singular intention of mindfulness is to understand and to bring about the end of emotional and psychological distress and suffering. And it's also to bring about the end of the roots of suffering in anger and in confusion. And it is directed towards wakefulness. It's directed towards liberation. You could say that mindfulness has many friends. It never comes to the party alone. And mindfulness is always in cooperation with these friends, and that's what gives the power of transformation. Now, in a very kind of implicit way, many of these friends of mindfulness are actually woven into all practices of insight meditation. And it is not attitudinally neutral. Mindfulness is not a cold observation. Mindfulness always has the attitude of befriending, of warmth, of welcoming, of embracing. What is the first job of mindfulness, we might say? Well, the first job of mindfulness is to illuminate the moment. It's to wake up the moment. Now, here you probably may have experienced this so directly today. You know, if you go out on your walking path and your mind is filled with preoccupations and planning and anxiety and rehearsals and unfinished arguments, you know, you might find that you wouldn't even hear the bell. And you might also come back into this room with the rather startling awareness that you've spent half an hour walking up and down, and looked like a great meditator, by the way. Looked like you were doing a fantastic job. And yet you might come back with the unwelcome awareness that you have not seen a single thing. That you've not heard the sounds arising and passing, that you've not felt the air on your face, that you've not been awake to the landscape of your body, or seen the trees silhouetted against the sky. You may go out another walking period and walk on exactly the same path, mindfully present, intentionally mindful, and get a felt sense of the way that mindfulness almost seems to awaken the world. That sense of the immediacy of the scene of the tree against the sky. You know, that the simplicity of being touched by the sounds and the sights that are entering your field of consciousness. And you have that sense that in illuminating the world, there's a sense of aliveness, of immediacy, of connectedness. And this is really what mindfulness is all about. And this is often what we refer to as being present. It's what we refer to as being present. It's that sense of aliveness, of being present in the presence of all things. Now, I'm sure you see in your experience that we seem to go in and out of that, don't we? Sometimes we feel to be quite present in the presence of things, and then it seems to fade, and we go somewhere else, and we're not quite sure where we went to, but then we come back, and again there can be the sense of, again, that aliveness, the sparkling immediacy of the moment. And of course, what happens with practice is that fading becomes less and less. Now, what we experience in the walking practice in terms of our sense of being present with things, present with each unfolding moment, and the illumination of the moment is, of course, exactly the same effect of what happens when we shine the light of mindfulness upon our inner world, upon the life of our body, the life of our emotions, the life of our minds. We become more intimate with what is going on. We come to know what is going on. It is like that landscape, inner landscape, is illuminated by mindfulness. What we also notice is that this cannot be conditional. That the very nature of mindfulness is that it is unconditional. We can't choose to be mindful only of the lovely, which of course would be preferable. But we cannot choose to be only mindful of the lovely. We see that as we start to be more awake in our lives, more awake in ourselves, that mindfulness embraces the entirety of our inner landscape. This is not always good news for us initially. We say, you know, that's why people say at times, you know, well, you know, my practice is one insult after another, or, you know, I was really much happier before I began to meditate. I've heard that one. But we cannot ignore the unlovely no matter how much we try. We see this illumination inwardly is part of waking up. It's like your leg waking up after being asleep. It's like coming out of a dream. Suddenly that unconditional welcoming of all things. But it is challenging. It is challenging. Because as we start to wake up, you know, and what I hear so often is people saying, you know, I never knew before I began to be mindful just how judgmental I could be, you know, or how blaming I could be, or how much aversion lived within me, or how intolerant I was, or how I never realized until I started trying to be mindful how mindless I was. Now, I think for many people in practice, when you begin to sit and when you begin to cultivate more wakefulness, they can feel that there are far more unlovely moments than lovely ones. But it's so important to see that this is part of a process of waking up. Because we do meet the hindrances, don't we? I mean, we all meet the hindrances, I think. You know, the winds of dullness, the winds of anxiety, you know, the winds of aversion and craving and doubt that distort our capacity to be where we are. But it's also true that mindfulness seems to open the door to really seeing even far more complex, powerful emotional states that have long histories. You know, we often start to get in touch with, you know, tendencies or experiences of anxiety or unworthiness or a wounded sense of self that seems to go back as far as we can remember. Now, this is where the friends of mindfulness are so important. Because simply watching all of this unfold with a kind of cold, dispassionate eye could be a prescription to send us into an abyss of despair and helplessness. to look in the eye of fear, depression, or sadness with a kind of cold disinterest could actually be a prescription for spiraling into despair. And it is why mindfulness really never does stand alone, why it needs its friends and it needs the allies that allow the possibility of understanding and being free within the difficult. The first of those allies that I mentioned briefly is the attitude of kindness and compassion. This is integral, I think, to any process of waking up. Without kindness and compassion, when we see the difficult, we have blame. And it is kindness and compassion that rescue suffering from blame. And personally, I could never emphasize too much how essential kindness and compassion are in this journey. Not only for ourselves, but for all that we meet and all those that we meet, to have an attitude of forgiveness, to have an attitude of generosity, of tolerance and patience, all part of the fabric of kindness. Without those, mindfulness becomes something not transforming. Because how can we be close? How can we befriend the difficult without kindness? And that sounds so simple, but isn't it one of the easiest lessons to forget? How much more easily we shift into judgment or blame or comparing or evaluation. And the kindness of mindfulness is constantly calling us back to know that that is only a way of compounding suffering. And that kindness and compassion allows us to embrace all that moves through our consciousness without them becoming a gatekeeper of our hearts. It is so necessary because we so understand that this very human instinct to flee from the painful. It's part of our genetic history. You know, it's hardwired almost into our consciousness. Pain or the intimation of pain signals flight. It is a very human instinct. But what we do begin to understand is that aversion for, or fear of, or resistance to pain only compounds pain. The Buddha put forward this very, very simple statement, saying that hatred is never healed by hatred. But that by love alone is hatred healed, and that this is an eternal and timeless law. So how does this apply to mindfulness? Well, we're not encouraging anyone here to love pain, to discover some newfound capacity to be affectionate towards pain, you know, or to like it. But what we are encouraging ourselves to understand is that the aversion to pain will only ever add another layer of suffering and make the painful more intractable. What is kindness? It's not a sentimentality, you know, it's not even necessarily a particular emotion. What does kindness look like in mindfulness? Well, sometimes it's a simple willingness to meet the difficult, to turn our attention towards the difficult in a caring way, rather than fleeing. It's counterintuitive, but it's the first and the singular most important step of mindfulness practice. Kindness is sometimes a simple willingness to touch the difficult with a mindful curiosity, rather than to condemn it. Kindness is sometimes the willingness to take the blame out of the painful. It is not my fault. It is not my fault. That's not a recipe for irresponsibility. But it is an acknowledgement that throughout our lives we have never been entirely in control of the matrix of conditions that have come together to make us who we are in this moment. It is not my fault. Kindness is sometimes the willingness to care about what is going on, rather than to abandon it. And without kindness, I think it's so important to see that mindfulness can sometimes become just another weapon of blame or accusation. I am so judgmental. You know, I am so anxious. I am so aversive. I think we need to learn the landscape of kindness to actually learn the landscape of mindfulness. And it's almost reteaching ourselves something. It's almost re-educating our hearts in a very real way to welcome and to befriend rather than to defend and resist. And we learn this in practice. It is part of that rotation of consciousness. It's a part of that shift in orientation. But I want to look at some of the other allies of mindfulness. That play a major part in the cognitive shifts that mindfulness asks for. Because I think it's so important to acknowledge that mindfulness is certainly not an end in itself. That mindfulness is the vehicle for making the cognitive shifts that we call insights. So, the first job of mindfulness is to know, just to know, simply know what is going on, to know what is happening. The second friend of mindfulness is to investigate. This is part of the fabric of understanding. Sometimes one of my colleagues calls it an affectionate curiosity. To investigate, to understand what is happening within ourselves. To understand how our personal world of the moment is being shaped and formed. To investigate that, to be interested in that, to really get a sense of how, you know, the sight of a piece of French bread on the dining room table can catapult us into this world of memories where we got divorced in a French restaurant and, you know, the associations within that of what a useless and unlovable person I am. My world of the moment being shaped about how an unreturned smile from somewhere in here that we've been friends with in the past can trigger this whole cycle of associations and proliferations that convince us, you know, that we are absolutely an unacceptable person. To see a child on the football pitch, you know, can catapult us into a world, you know, where we remember ourselves as being that innocent little child, you know, loving to play and whatever happened to me and how did I end up here. This is the job of mindfulness, to investigate how our world is being shaped and formed moment to moment. Now it's so important to see that this investigation is not just thinking. That's not what we, although thinking is part of investigation, reflection. This kind of investigation is so experiential, but it's so important in terms of taking the sense of bewilderment and puzzlement and helplessness out of our lives. When we can be mindful and investigate, there is a wonderful blessing in no longer having to ask ourselves that question, how did I end up here? Usually followed by the word again. How did I end up here again? I mean, have you ever found yourself coming out of the tail end of some huge psychological and emotional storm and it sort of just ends somehow and you look back and you say, how did that happen? You know, how did I end up there again? That sense of bewilderment makes us feel so helpless. What we do begin to see with mindfulness is that we can know, we can understand, and we can begin to see how that world is constructed. That knowing, I think, removes the sense of impotence and helplessness out of distress. Removing the sense of impotence and helplessness out of distress is so much part of the fabric of beginning to feel a quality of confidence within ourselves. The confidence and faith in our own capacity to rescue our own hearts and minds from distress and to nurture that which is truly, actually reliable and sustainable. We begin to see that some of these flights or these surges of world building, they're not a life sentence. You know, there may be other pathways we can walk. One of the gifts of mindfulness is not only to illuminate our inner world, but to slow it down. Just to slow it down. And when that happens, we begin to sense maybe there is another way of being. Maybe there's not just that assumption, this is what I am, or this is who I am. Maybe there is another way of responding to this moment. Maybe it's not just about manipulating the world or changing the furniture in my world. Maybe truly it is that possibility of transforming the shape of my own mind. The freedom that can be tasted in that. The third ally of mindfulness is energy or effort. Energy or effort. It's so important to see what drains energy and what creates energy. When we're very stuck or feel very stuck in the sense of bewilderment or helplessness, we can see how quickly it follows on the footsteps of that, a sense of inertia. You know, nothing I can do about this. You know, this is who I am, the sense of weariness. When we begin to know that it's possible to walk a pathway of healing, that actually brings energy. But it also requires energy. Waking up requires a lot of energy. In Buddhist psychology, these words energy or effort, again, are words that have a whole spectrum of nuances. They include courage, fearlessness, perseverance, patience, dedication. Now, I think it's true that people say that they often feel they don't have enough energy to do this. That they just don't feel like they have enough energy or their willingness. I think it's a really important question to ask of ourselves how we use the energy that we have. And if you think of your mind just in the course of an ordinary day, think of the enormous amount of energy that we can put into obsession, that we can put into fantasy, that we can put into proliferation, into rumination. Think of how much energy at times we put into avoiding the things and people we don't like. It takes a lot of effort. Think of how much energy and effort we put into pursuing the things and people that we like and want. I think there's a very real question about how wisely or unwisely, how mindfully or unmindfully, how consciously or unconsciously we use the energy that is available to us. It's always so interesting to me, like you know, when I teach retreats, you know, and be honest about it, you know, I mean, retreats are not running marathons, you know. Sit around. It's basically sit around. Just on occasion, we go for just a little toddle down a path, and then, you know, we sit around more. I mean, it hardly looks particularly demanding or strenuous, does it? And yet people say, I'm so exhausted. I can't stay awake. you know, we're probably doing one of the most restful things that's possible to do. I'm so tired. Why? Now, as I mentioned this morning, there is a kind of honest tiredness. But so much of that weariness is often born, quite frankly, of being lost in thought. It's often born of being just lost in thought. This also has not to do with weariness that is born of ill health or illness or any of those conditions. Now, personally, I think it's so interesting for us to notice the links between interest, intention, and energy. Intention, and energy. You know, like if we were showing a really fascinating movie in here, you know, and we were all like really absorbed, you know, really interested, you notice you don't have to keep shouting at yourself to come back. You know, like the intention is there and the energy is there to sustain that intention and attention. And you can feel the flavor of it is so unforced, isn't it? I mean, when you're really interested in something, if you're interested in your partner, you know, if you're interested in the person you're with, if you're interested in what you're doing, the energy level feels very unforced, isn't it? You don't have to command yourself. You don't have to shout at yourself. There's this very kind of unhesitating availability of energy. Okay, so how does that apply to our practice? How does that apply to our practice? Are we interested in waking up? This is such a crucial question. Or is it low down the list of our priorities? Are we genuinely interested in kindness? It comes back to that kind of tension I was talking about this morning, doesn't it? I mean, we may be very passionately interested in kindness, but at the same time, we kind of like treasure the self-righteousness that can come with aversion. So our energy and our intentionality is often quite divided. And I think part of this fabric of investigation, and I think this is a really crucial part of the fabric of investigation, it's really clarifying what we are deeply interested in. Now, sometimes we notice that we have interest and motivation that is startled into wakefulness by life events. I mean, if you've had the experience of someone you care deeply about dying, you know, the loss of someone you love. If you notice how often that does bring suddenly this renewal of sense of urgency, you know, like the fragility of this life. What am I doing with my time? What am I doing with my attention? It's there. And yet so easy it gets sort of whittled away, doesn't it? If you see, you know, if you're faced with some tremendous suffering in the world, you know, how you often feel that passionate arising of compassion. You know, the wish to reach out, to heal. And it can feel so immediate and so wholehearted and so alive. And yet often it just seems to get whittled away again. And I think it's why in this teaching, you know, the Buddha puts so much emphasis upon reflecting upon what we are dedicated to. Because what we are dedicated to will be the shape of our lives. What we are dedicated to will be the shape of our mind. And he wasn't talking about then, you know, leaving, you know, fleeing from the world, you know, abandoning our relationships, you know, withdrawing from life. But he's talking about this treasuring of wakefulness. There's a word for it in Pali, which is samvega. And it means a spiritual urgency. Spiritual urgency. And I think the way that urgency is used here is not in terms of haste. But a dedication, a spiritual urgency for awakening. Now, energy is so important. I mean, what actually people see as they practice is that they have increasing access to levels of energy which they previously did not have. And I think that is part of the energy that is born of collectiveness, part of the energy that is born of curiosity, you know, part of the energy that's born of that sense of aliveness. But energy is also, it's born of investigation, but it's also sometimes born of disidentification. No, because I think you really see that when the mind is going through life, just identifying, holding, trying to keep, it consumes so much energy. And actually learning with mindfulness to find a little more ease, a little more trust, a little more confidence in our being, to loosen, soften the grip of identification, somehow begins to release that capacity for aliveness. And it's so important because, as I've talked about here, swimming against the tide of habit requires considerable effort. But swimming with the tide of habit consumes an enormous amount of energy. And it's really kind of where we make those choices. I would love to be able to walk into a retreat and just be able to say to people, well, just show up, you know, it's enough, you know, just hang out in your cushion and everything will be revealed. For some, that might be realistic. For most, it would not be realistic. Energy and effort is what engages mindfulness with life. And energy and effort is what rescues mindfulness from passivity. And I think this is so important. You know, because sometimes we have this idea that mindfulness is just watching, just watching, just watching, just watching. But mindfulness is meant to engage us with life. It is meant to, and energy rescues mindfulness from passivity. To be able to come back, to be able to come back to this moment, to our breath, to our body, all requires a mindful effort. But what enables us to understand, what enables us to take our place. Without effort and energy, I think that mindfulness could possibly be a way of just becoming a more horrified spectator upon our own disasters. Because it's not just about looking, it's about what we cultivate. And the next ally of mindfulness is joy. It's joy. Not an inflated state of elation or bliss or ecstasy. I mean, can you imagine telling someone who's depressed, you know, connect with rapture? You know, can you imagine telling yourself when you're in the midst of some aversive state, be happy? It doesn't really work, does it? But this practice of mindfulness is not to cultivate a sense of grimness. It's not to make us downcast. It is to cultivate spaciousness and ease and appreciation and learning to taste the possibility of joy. Now, what is, I think, kind of curious is that probably most of us would love to have more joy in our lives. Most of us would like to have the joy. And yet, it seems that we almost have to reteach ourselves our capacity for joy. It's an interesting one. To reteach ourselves our capacity for joy. So how do we begin to taste joy? How do we begin to taste joy? I think it has a lot to do with how we what we choose to pay attention to. Now, I think we would all recognize, you know, that we do tend, many of us, to be problem-centered. We focus on what's wrong. Have you noticed that? We focused on what's wrong. Now, cultivating joy is not Pollyanna-ish thinking. It's not the kind of thinking that, oh, everything is wonderful and everything is terrific, you know, and everything's lovely. Clearly, in this world, everything is not. But it's about paying attention not only to what is amiss, but what is well. There's so many qualities of a joy. You know, one quality of joy is appreciative joy. Appreciative joy. Just being able to go outside and appreciate. Appreciate the seeing, the hearing, the touching. Just be able to stand still and allow yourself to be touched. sometimes joy very much is inwardly generated and inwardly born. And this is so much the essence of, I think, Buddhist practice, is to discover a quality of happiness that is inwardly generated. Because so often our conventional view of happiness is that it is linked to conditions and events. If I have good conditions and events, I'm happy. If I have difficult conditions and events, I am unhappy. It is like the world of conditions is made out to be the gatekeeper of joy. What Buddhist tradition is teaching, what Buddhist teaching is really showing or pointing towards, is an inwardly generated joy. The contentment and joy of within our own hearts. Part of it is appreciative joy. Part of it is actually noticing what is well. Noticing what is well. You know, I remember once I was teaching a retreat with a friend of mine. And I arrived, and he just started asking me this series of questions. He says, you know, did your car start this morning? I said, yeah, actually, it did. Did you have something, just food for breakfast? Yeah, I did, you know. You managed to get here on time, too. Yes, well, your children well? Yes, they're quite well, thank you, you know. And, you know, every question he asked me, I could feel my sort of consciousness expanding to the sense of, I actually didn't notice all of that. No, I actually didn't notice it. You know, I'd arrived here in this kind of like slightly shriveled space, you know, about what I had to do today, you know, and what I had to sort of undertake. And I could just feel that actually noticing of what is well. You notice I can sometimes in meditation practice, you know, people come to practice often with chronic pain, or if they don't have chronic pain, they have something that hurts. I mean, I think that's part of aging for me, is the pauses when nothing hurts get shorter and shorter. So something I can almost always rely on it, you know, something's going to hurt today. But do I notice what is not hurting? Don't you notice what is not hurting? If the mind is agitated, do you notice what is not agitated? Is your ear agitated? You know, are your lips agitated? If you can feel yourself contracted, can you notice what is not contracted? What are we doing with our attention? What we are doing with our attention is part of how we are building our world. Now, cultivating that mindfulness of what is well is not a denial of what is unwell. But I'm sure you have noticed, as I have noticed, that the difficult is far more embraceable in a consciousness that is spacious and easeful. And calm. That the difficult is so unapproachable with a mind that is contracted and is in contention, arguing. And there is something to do with knowing that the climate of our mind, the climate of our very moods, the climate of our mind states, is also not something that is accidental, but it has much to do with how we are paying attention. It is so critical for us in this practice, in this life, which holds so much challenge and so much difficulty, to know the ways to gladden our hearts, to know the ways to brighten our minds and to gladden our hearts and to make it a practice. You know, none of these allies of mindfulness are an accident either. They are also trainings. They are also cultivations. To learn even the small tastes of joy. Because joy, I think, opens the door to another ally of mindfulness, which is calm. Calmness, serenity, tranquility. I think when we speak or think about calm, we often think about it just as being the opposite of agitation, a certain state. But mindfulness practice is actually really not that concerned with states that come and go. Mindfulness practice is much more concerned with orientation. Now, calm, I think, is one of these words that it's really crucial to translate into a verb. And to think about calming. Calming. What are we calming? Well, actually, we're calming everything that is agitated. We're calming agitated thinking. We're calming the anxious body. We're calming the tendency of the mind to proliferate and ruminate. Do you ever find that you wake up in the morning and it's almost like agitation is waiting for you, like your shoes? You know, just step right into it. You know, all my projects for the day, all the things I got to do, the places I got to get to, things I have to accomplish, all the things that are facing me. It's like agitation just sitting there waiting for you to step right in. You know, put it on. Maybe you don't have to. Maybe you don't have to. Maybe we can start to begin to practice calming. It's interesting, you know, in Chinese calligraphy, I'm told, that the calligraphy signal for busyness is heart killing. It translates as heart killing. And calming is very much about heart nurturing or heart nourishing. This is one of the easiest practices to undertake simply because we don't have to look very far to find what's agitated. It's one of the simplest practices to undertake, but it also takes so much intention to know how to stop, to know how to calm the busyness, which is not about turning us into non-productive human beings. But I don't know how it is for you, but I find I'm really not that effective when I'm agitated. I find calmness is one of the great gifts. You know, calmness is a gift then of calm in thinking, calm in acting, calm in speaking. The forerunner. We start to notice the moments when we feel driven by haste, by urgency, by compulsion. Those are the moments we're leaning forward, and if we lean forward far enough, we fall flat on our face. There's something about learning to come back upright and to pay the kind of attention to our bodies and minds that actually does bring about calmness. Which I think brings us to the last ally of mindfulness, which is equanimity. And equanimity is sometimes translated as unshakable poise, but I think it's also good to note, just note that in Buddhist teaching, equanimity is used interchangeably with nibbana. It's used interchangeably with liberation. Because equanimity is really about, it's not about indifference, it's not about armoring ourselves, it's not about protecting ourselves. In fact, it's about being deeply caring and being deeply intimate. In the Zen tradition or Tibetan tradition, sometimes translated about the willingness to be equally near all things. It's about being able to be upright, not governed by craving and aversion. This is why it is equated with liberation, that the mind is no longer governed by greed, hatred, and delusion. Equanimity actually really points to one of the fruits of the practice, and it also points out to one of the trainings. And one of the trainings in equanimity is to take the I out of experience. It's to take the self out of experience. If you look at the times, you know, when we get most off balance, aren't they the times when we hear the sense of me shouting so strongly? It's really learning what it means to soften the identification and to soften the selfing. Soften the selfing, which I'm going to talk about much more to get tomorrow. Of all, as I've mentioned so many times today, so many conditions that we cannot control in this life, but we are not helpless. And we're not helpless in what we can cultivate. And what we cultivate is not only mindfulness, but all of the allies of mindfulness, of equanimity, of investigation, of energy, of calmness, of slowing down. This is what awakens our world. This is what changes our hearts. And for most of us, this really is a moment-to-moment cultivation. It's a moment-to-moment dedication. So, think that's a good place to stop. Thank you.